Hello and welcome to this week's No Name Ever, your Clarets podcast. I'm Kevin and joining me this week are James and Natalie to talk about just another away win, this time at Anfield. Liverpool dominated pretty much every stat other than the one that counts, goals. And the first of all sent the away fans into raptures. The Reds replied almost immediately but couldn't find a way past an impressive Nick Pope making his first league start for the Clarets. It continues an impressive start to the season from Burnley, with now unbeaten on the road having played Chelsea, Spurs and Liverpool. Natalie, James, what did you make of the result?
Obviously I thought it was a great point to get away from home. Obviously Liverpool had a lot of shots but I think we kept them at distance. We played a really good game and it's sort of the polar opposite of what we've come to expect away from home. A great point, and it just continues the way we've kicked the season off in such a positive way away from home.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think it was a hard game. It was definitely not one for the nerves, I can tell you that. I think I aged about 30 years after leaving Anfield on Saturday. So it's a cracking point, and I think it's one that we fully deserved. I will literally happily argue with any Liverpool fan out there that Burnley fully deserved that point. I think to be beaten would have been very, very, very harsh.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I want to start talking today about Scott Arfield. So I think he's having somewhat of a resurgence in a new role this season, isn't he? I think it was his first goal since October, and he's had two very impactful input performances in the middle of a 4-5-1 now. So, James, do you think he's got a bigger role to play this season than we previously thought? He appears to be ahead of Ashley Westwood in the pecking order at the moment.
I think they're obviously two completely different players. What I would say about Scott Arfield is, obviously, previously we've always seen him playing in that wide role, and I think maybe he doesn't have what it takes at the top level to play in that wide role anymore, and I think that came across in a lot of fans' frustrations sort of at times last season, but however when he's played in this more advanced central midfield role, it seems to have worked really well for him. And I'm not sure whether it's sort of less of an emphasis on having to, you know, do the backward and forward of the being on the wings, or just maybe he feels less pressure being in that position. But personally, I think he's really grown into playing in that position, and it's going to be a difficult one, I think, for Dyche when Hendrick comes back. On, you know, can you really drop someone who's played in that position twice, and so far he's had a great impact on both occasions? Whereas I think Hendrick's start to the season has maybe been a little bit more muted.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a question I thought we'd be asking before the season. Is does Arfield stay in the team ahead of Hendrick? But it's a fantastic problem to have, I think. Natalie, I found the pundits' analysis of the match quite bemusing. I think we've all been talking up about how well we defended, but also throwing in the 35 shots stat that Liverpool have had and suggested that they really deserve to win. Lee Ashworth tweeted a fantastic stat on Twitter afterwards. He said, in the last three games between Burnley and Liverpool, Liverpool have taken 71 shots, scored three goals and picked up 4 points, whereas we've taken just 19 shots but scored more goals, four, and also picked up 4 points. So which do you think is it, Natalie? Did we defend well or did Liverpool deserve to win? Which was it?
I don't think Liverpool deserved to win. I think the analysis of the game from the pundits and the national media at the weekends really irritated me more than anything. So this is literally how this game went from a non-Liverpool bias, from somebody who was at the game and saw the game and knew exactly what had happened. Yes, Liverpool were very good. Yes, Liverpool threw everything they could at us. It was a very, very fast-paced game and the Burnley players could hardly get a chance to stop for breath. It was just relentless attack. However, as impressive as they were in midfield, Coutinho especially was very, very good in midfield. They dominated that battle and they kept possession all the time. They never really looked like having they didn't make any misses, should I say, sorry, that were shocking misses. The stats say that there was, 30-odd shots on target. The vast majority of those shots were from way, way, way out of the area. Very long-range efforts that were never going anywhere near the goal. Pope could save them comfortably, or a defender could clear them off the line, or not off the line, but very close to the line. And that was because of Burnley's defending. Yes, we had to defend. We had to try and nullify that relentless attack, but it was very, very effective. And that solid back four of defence pushed the Liverpool players back to, and reduced them to only being able to shoot from long range. So yes, the stats may very well show that Liverpool dominated the game. And you might look at those shots and go, oh my God, Liverpool battered Burnley. How did they not win 6-0? Well, they didn't win 6-0 because a stat that shows shots on target doesn't ever tell you the true story of the quality of those shots on target or how close they were or just how much of an important miss they were for the Liverpool players. Klopp, for me, was very evasive at the weekend, and I think he was very savvy in the way he approached this in the media, and he concentrated on the dominating in possession and how classy it looked in the midfield. But he should really look at that Liverpool side and say, well, for all of the possession that they had and for all of their dominance in midfield, they never really looked like properly scoring. And I think, to be honest, Burnley, but the two shot headers that Ben Mee had towards the end were probably better chances for one of the teams to go ahead than any of the Liverpool shots. Sure, you know, Nick Pope made a couple of really good saves, but we're talking here about a very small handful of chances. So I think from a possession and from a midfield battle perspective, yes, Liverpool deserved... No, hang on, let me rephrase that. From a midfield battle and from a possession perspective, yes, Liverpool dominated the stats and played better. But from a clear-cut perspective, as in, what have we done enough here to score a goal, which I would remind all of the national media is what you actually need to get the points. Possession stats do not win you games. Then it was a lot more even than those stats suggest. And quite frankly, wouldn't have been a horrible, horrible travesty if Burnley had nicked a win.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that you mentioned the stats there, actually. Another tweet I noticed after the match was there was two, actually, Dave Roberts and also North American Clarets, both tweeted very similar graphs showing the positions of the shots which Liverpool took. It really demonstrates how far back we forced them to go from. I think, according to Dave, Liverpool only created one clear-cut chance other than the goal. So I think that says a lot for me. With all the talk of Liverpool's shots, there seems to be a little mention of Ben Mee's chances, which you talked about there, Natalie. I think twice with 10 minutes to go, twice we found him unmarked from corners. And on another day, you could say that one of those finds its way in. James, do you think that would have been deserved if Ben Mee had scored at the end? And could he have done better and actually found the goal?
It's difficult to say. I mean, you can always look at these chances that were maybe not clear-cut, but sort of half chances and look at them and say what would have been if it had gone in. Obviously Ben Mee wasn't able to take the opportunity, and I think if you look at the balance of the game, you know, I know that a lot of Liverpool shots are from distance, but I think in many ways they were the better attacking side, and at the end of the day a point probably fair. But saying that, if we could have stolen all 3 points, then I certainly would have been complaining whether it was deserved or not.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. To both of you, very briefly, I know when the fixture list was first announced, we saw this run of opening away games, and it really worried me. I thought we'd be pointless on the road until at least October, and my concern was that a run of defeats could really affect our confidence and then end up leading to another situation like last year when we really struggled really badly on the road. So very quickly, both of you, did you hold any hope whatsoever of us coming away from these three games, Chelsea, Spurs and Liverpool, with anything at all? What do you think, Natalie?
No. But an ability perspective, just more from a psychological perspective. I worried that we left it so late last season to get rid of that away form curse, and it was, you know, it was away at Palace, and it was great to do that, but I just felt like it was too late towards the end of the season, and they only managed to do it once, and I worried that the hoodoo was going to, you know, marry on to this season, especially with three really difficult games. But I always believe that they have the ability to get something from these games if they could get over those psychological problems.
If you look at our away record previous in the Premier League, it was hard to see us coming away with points against such big sides. But then when you look at the way we did play against some of the big sides away from home, I think the fact that we didn't come away with anything was more down to bad luck than necessarily bad performances. We seem to have this knack of raising our game when we play bigger sides. But previously away from home, it's not actually converted into points. But this season, obviously, we managed to see that change. But still saying that, particularly Chelsea, obviously going away to the champions, definitely didn't expect anything there. Probably thought we'd, you know, be comfortably beaten. Spurs, you think there's a chance because of their record at Wembley. So obviously a fantastic point there. And then Liverpool, again, one who you think, if we play to the best of our ability, we've got every chance of coming away with something. But in the past, these have typically been the games where we've just not had that little rub of the green.
Yeah, Natalie, you mentioned the psychology of it there. And I said I was worried that if we'd got a load of defeats, it would have affected our confidence. Mm. Do you think now it works the other way around? Do you think these wins give us belief? And what does it mean, if anything, for our season as a whole?
Well, it's got to be hugely encouraging, doesn't it? Because one of the problems that we faced last year was a huge reliance on home form. If you can manage to get some points away from... if you manage to get some points away from home, that takes that pressure off your home form. And it means that if you do have a couple of hiccups, like, say, West Brom at home this season, it isn't the end of the world. You've managed to get some points on the board, because I think a lot of the experts in the pre-season analysis all said, can Burnley do it again at home to maintain their position in the league? If they don't, they're going to get relegated. And just think, managing to get these wins in the early part of the season, it just shows that last season was just a bit of a freak at the end of the day. You know, we managed to play very well in some of those games and we're unlucky to come away with nothing. And actually, what I tend to look at as a good marker for this is how much it's been talked about in the press. The comparison of away form to this season and last season is pretty much non-existent from what I've seen in the press at the moment. Now, bearing in mind that we're in a 24/7 news cycle where Sky Sports Sky Sports News, other media outlets and newspapers as well, you know, they need headlines for clicks. You know, they tend to pick up on anything they can. So the fact that they're not even using the comparison between last season and this season and in our away form just shows that I don't think anybody actually thinks it's a thing anymore. And they just think, oh, it was just a one-off last season and we're going to be fine.
I think it's very good to get it banished and hopefully never to be spoken of ever again, ever. Now, obviously, the big story of the game was our new sleeve sponsor. Obviously, the big story of the game was Nick Pope's full Premier League debut. He's very inexperienced. I was looking, actually. He's only played around half a season in the Championship. And before that, the highest he played was League Two. So, he's not... Sean Dyche mentioned it, I think, either before or after the match. But he's very young in terms of games. And I don't think it showed myself. I think he played very well. What do you think, James?
Yeah, I think it was an accomplished performance from someone who's making his first full debut. It's a difficult spot to be put in because Tom Heaton's been such a big player for us in the Premier League. To come in the way he did in the last game, I think he did very, very well. It's a difficult position to come in when, you know, you see your captain, I'd imagine the leader of the squad off the pitch as well as on the pitch, go off like that. Knowing it could be quite a long layoff, and I'd imagine he felt quite a lot of pressure in that game. So then to come out and to make your full debut at somewhere like Anfield, a club with a lot of history at the highest level in the English game, it must have been a lot of pressure, but he's done well. I don't think he's had too many difficult saves to make. I think a lot of routine stuff, thanks to keeping Liverpool mainly to distant shots. But obviously he did make the one outstanding save, and it's saves like that you need goalkeepers to make when the pressure's on, and you know you need someone to pull something off, pull something out of the hat to save the day. He managed to do that, and I think that's highly commendable in a first performance to have the composure to make that save.
One unexpected thing to come from Nick Pope's leap into the limelight is his namesake Nick Pope, the UFO investigator. No, really. He's won a few fans on Twitter this week after he was repeatedly mistaken for our Nick Pope. So, of course, we had to speak to him. If it's possible that anyone has not seen your tweets yet, introduce who you are and what you do.
Well, I used to work for the British government at the Ministry of Defence, and I ran their UFO project. So the media know me as the real-life Fox Mulder, and I've been on about a zillion TV shows talking about UFOs, the unexplained, and conspiracy theories.
It sounds like a fascinating job, investigating UFOs for the Ministry of Defence. What I can't even begin to think what a day in that job might be like. What is a day in the life of an MOD UFO investigator?
Well, it wasn't quite like the X-Files you see on TV. It was more interviewing witnesses, checking to see if anything was tracked on military radar, getting photographs and videos analysed. You might have questions from the media. The subject might get raised in Parliament, in which case you'd have to brief the Secretary of State for Defence. You might even have kids doing school projects writing in and asking for help. So there really wasn't a typical day, but it was all good fun and absolutely fascinating.
It certainly doesn't sound like the life of a footballer. So what happened when people first started mistaking you for our Nick Pope on Twitter?
Well, I'd known about Nick for some time, and indeed my fantasy football team at the Ministry of Defence is even called I'm Not Burnley's Reserve Keeper.
But, fantastic.
And I'd seen obviously that there was a player with the same name as myself and that he'd been kind of rising through the ranks. But things didn't really explode until, of course, the bad news for Tom about his injury and then Nick having to step up and take that first team place with Heaton being injured. And at that point, I started to get a few tweets, and I wasn't sure at first whether they were just tongue-in-cheek and people were just having a joke, or whether people were genuinely mistaking the two Nick Popes. So I made a couple of tweets and said, no, I don't have a second career as Burnley's keeper. And then, for your information, I'm the guy that ran the government's UFO project, not the guy keeping goal for Burnley. And then it just exploded.
Yeah, the tweets I've seen has had masses of likes and retweets. Is it your most popular tweets ever, or have you had fame in other ways on Twitter?
Well, no, this was easily, I think, the most popular. And as you say, I got a whole stack of retweets, and I think that Burnley FC picked it up, and various other people associated with Burnley, with the Premiership more generally. Some big names in there started following me in the football world. And yeah, I think we got something like a million impressions or whatever it is they call it on Twitter. I'm not a huge expert on this, but it exploded. My own followers in 2 days went up from, I think, about 10,000 to 12,000, which was, pretty remarkable. And I tried to play it tongue in cheek. I mean, I tried to be a good sport about this, and I saw the funny side, of course, and I said something like, well, I expect the other Nick will get questions about aliens, and I'll get comments and questions about closing down a big centre forward coming in, lining up a shot or something.
I really, really, really hope your other Nick does get questions about aliens. That'd be fantastic. It got a bit more interesting when somebody called Tom Heaton reached out to you on Twitter and said that he was having a similar thing. Have you chatted about your common experience? What was it like to talk to someone with the same thing happening at the same time in a similar situation?
I haven't actually talked to him. I liked his tweet. It was superb. He responded, I think, with, I feel your pain, Nick. And that, of course, then went viral as well. And things kind of only took off from there. The Sun saw the story on my Twitter feed and ran a story on it. I understand it was picked up as well by Talk Sport. And I actually posted a couple of tweets where I said, obviously, nobody likes to see any footballer injured, and we all wish Tom a speedy and quick recovery, but of course I was sort of interested in Nick getting a good chance, and said, good luck, hope you have a great game, and clearly it's going to be very good for him. And although I'm an Arsenal fan, I hasten to say, of course, I wished that Nick had kept a clean sheet, but I know that even though that wasn't possible, he by all accounts had an absolutely cracking game against Liverpool. Hugely difficult game for him as the first Premiership start, and played all the way through, and I saw that the manager was saying great things, that the pundits were saying great things. So I wish him you know, all the very best. And I've started to follow him. He started to follow me. So, you know, this is an interesting situation.
Absolutely. Yeah, you touched on it a bit there. And you mentioned that you were aware of him previously. But has this motivated you to follow Burnley games and follow Nick's career a little bit more?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, when you came up into the Premiership, I was always interested. And you always wonder with the teams that are promoted whether they're going to go straight back down. But, you know, Burnley, I think, have done very, very well. I am interested, not least because when I lived in the UK, I emigrated, actually, now live in the US. So I don't follow the football quite as much, but still keep my hand in. Still have a fantasy football team entered in the Ministry of Defence League. I saw that obviously Gray had been sold and Keane had been sold. But I think I would say mid-table respectability. And everything I saw and heard about Nick's game prompts me to think that even with Heaton out, he'll do well, you'll do well, and it's looking like an interesting season.
I certainly hope so. That'd be fantastic. As James has just sent me a link to a story about a UFO sighting in Burnley in 2015, and also apparently there was one in 1995 that prompted 250 calls on the same day. So do you think Burnley is a key destination for UFOs?
Well, I don't know. I mean, people have all sorts of debates about what's a hot spot, but that's a lot of calls. That's a lot of calls from people saying something. So who knows? Now, you know, when all these stories come up, people say, why Burnley? Why wherever it is that people are having sightings? I don't know. I mean, I'm not one of these people who has a neat answer to the UFO mystery. I investigated it for the government, but we never got a definitive solution. And despite what the conspiracy theorists say, we honestly, hand on heart, don't have a spaceship hidden away in an Air Force hangar somewhere.
And finally, I saw a bright light in the sky last night, and I'm a bit worried it might be the start of an alien invasion. Is Burnley's title bid likely to be interrupted by an interplanetary war?
Oh, a title bid. Now that is big talk. I thought you were going to be talking about mid-table respectability.
I'm going to say, Nick, I think there's more chance of Burnley going for a title than Arsenal this season.
Oh, now that is fighting talk. It's early days. But Arsenal, well, I think the priority for Arsenal is going to be to get back into the Champions League. That's I think. But looking like a very promising side, and Lacazette looks like he's going to be a 20 plus goal a man season. So who knows? But alien invasion? No, I think you're all right. Keep watching the skies. But if Burnley don't get the title this season, don't try and blame aliens for it.
Damn it, that was my excuse gone. And very finally, Nick, if people want to keep tabs on your tweets and your updates on Nick Pope this season, how can they follow you?
My website is nickpope.net. That has all the information about my government work on these real-life X-Files. And my website also has links to Twitter and Facebook.
I am so, so happy that has just happened. It's probably the best thing we've ever done in our 7 years of as none and ever. This is a genuine request now. Please send us your own UFO experiences. We also asked Pope Francis for his thoughts on Nick's performance, but he never got back to us, so that's disappointing. So Natalie, onto the real Nick in the middle of our goal. He's very popular with the Burnley congregation already, isn't he? I think he's already got a cracking hymn.
Kevin.
He's got a cracking hymn. Ready? No, it's not over yet. And with all this alien nonsense going on, I'm just glad he didn't drop a clanger. I'm sorry.
Have you been working on those all day?
I mean, all
you
week.
You have, haven't you?
All week.
I get the feeling from Bronwyn's lack of reaction that she's actually made the connection with the clangers.
Yeah, it's the clangers is the thing.
The little pink knitted things.
The cartoon thing.
I think
thing.
The real question is, can you answer the next question in clanger?
Okay, I'm going to ask the next question in clangery. That was it. That's it. Okay, so. That translated is, seriously though, how incredible, Natalie, was that save at the end? I think... No, this is real. This is serious now. Come on. Peter Schmeichel. Peter Schmeichel said it was the best save of the season so far.
Oh, really? I didn't see that.
Yeah, he tweeted out saying that. I've been a bit surprised about the lack of attention it's had. I don't think it was mentioned on Match of the Day. And a lot of I think a lot of people have just had it going down as a miss going on straight onto the crossbar. But it certainly looked from the photos like a save for me. What do you think? Was it a save?
Well, it certainly looked in live time as a save. And we were right behind that net. And it looked like he got a hand to it. And we certainly didn't hear it, the ball ricochet off the crossbar, which he would have done, obviously, if it had hit the bar. So I'm going to go with a save. But I think as well, what makes it even more impressive is that you've got to bear in mind that most of the action was in our half throughout the full 90 minutes, apart from, you know, the few chances that Burnley had to break away into the Liverpool half. So whilst I did say earlier on that a lot of the shots were long range shots and, you know, it wasn't like Nick was having to dive down at every single opportunity, he did have to stay very, very, very alert for the entire match. So to still have the mental sharpness and the reactions at that late stage in the game, when he's had a very tough game, both mentally and physically, to still be able to pull off those saves right in the dying moments is really, really impressive for me.
Yeah, but I say particularly so after having played so little football over the last year or so. It must be a lot easier to stay focused when you're in the practice of doing so and being back every week. So yeah, it was fantastic for me. James, if that was as we all seem to think here, if that was a save, it's unbelievable. Is that better than Tom Heaton's save at Old Trafford last year, which got so much attention?
I'm not sure. That's a difficult one. I think it's a great reaction save. It's difficult. I'd say it's maybe on par with Heaton's save. I wouldn't say better. Heaton's save just hit him so hard that I think he said after he was surprised he didn't break his arm or something, that it made it all the more impressive, I think, that not only did he react to it, he didn't let it just go through him. Whereas obviously the one Pope was made, I think, a little bit more low velocity. So while it's a great reaction, I think it's a little bit easier for him maybe to not be overwhelmed by it. But I don't think you can take anything away from either save. They were both fantastic saves and obviously both key saves in the respective games.
How important, Natalie, was it for Nick Pope to come through his match with a good performance, considering that I thought he looked quite nervy last weekend and obviously he's not got a lot of experience at playing football at a decent level. So how important was it for him to come through and get through the match, really?
Well, of course, it was hugely important. I think it's going to give him even more confidence than he had going into the game. I think the Palace game, for me, I agree with you, Kevin. I think he did look nervous at the Palace game. I think he needed a couple of those shots to stop and a couple of those saves, didn't he, just to get himself grounded. But I think that's perfectly understandable. Dyche talks a lot about his players being ready to step up to the mark immediately on notice. I don't buy that with keepers, and I think with the best will in the world, keepers, especially when you deputise for Tom Heaton, you do not expect to come on to any game. So for the Palace game, he wasn't expecting to come on. He wasn't 100% mentally prepared. He wasn't 100% warmed up. He'd not trained with the first team all week. He'll have been, you know, keeper training, of course, but he wouldn't have been in the focus like Tom Heaton was. So he was naturally going to be a little bit under par, and that's perfectly understandable. That's not a criticism, that is just how it was, and I'm quite happy with that. What I said to the guys, and I think I might have mentioned this on last week's podcast as well, once we knew the extent of Tom Heaton's injury, Pope knows he's going to be in the nets now until at least January. What he's then got the opportunity to do is, number one, get his mind on the fact that he is now playing every single game for the next few months. He has the benefit of training with the first team, having the focus of the manager, the coaching staff and the goalkeeping staff to get him 100% ready for that game. So that will have improved him. And finally, he was going into a no-pressure game. Palace at home, another potential relegation rival, if we're going to look on the worst case scenario, was a high pressure game. He couldn't afford to let a goal in and lose us some points that we needed at home. Away at Anfield, nobody expected us to get anything, and they're not the games that dictate whether you stay in the Premier League. They are bonus points. So he had the benefit on Saturday of going out there and playing with confidence and playing in a relaxed frame of mind with nothing to lose. And I just think that all of those factors, plus the fact that he was very busy, so he actually was able to perform all the time just added to just the absolute perfect full debut for him. And I think it's just exactly what he needed just to really help him.
Fantastic. I also wanted to give a brief mention to Ben Mayhew, captain of the side, superbly, I thought. I think I think he was fantastic last season. He's had a fantastic start to this season, and there's been a few calls for England call-ups, which, if he continues playing like this, can only get louder, I think. Now, this podcast is going out on Tuesday, so most people will listen to it after the Leeds game. So, Natalie and James, think very carefully, as your next answer is going to make you look either like a genius or very, very stupid. Natalie, what are your expectations for the game?
My expectations for the game are that Dyche will not pay it very much attention at all. And that's not to be disrespectful to the cup, that's the reality. I think he paid more attention to the Blackburn game because that was a forced scenario, because he knew the lynching that the fans would give him if he played kids and we lost, and it would have just been horrendous. He knew the importance of that game for a fan, and he was probably annoyed that that fixture came out because it's not what he wanted from his squad. He now won't care whether Burnley get knocked out or not. So I expect more changes to the squad than there were for the Blackburn game. And I don't expect him to take it massively seriously. I think Leeds, on the other hand, will come in force. I think they will be a little bit more ambitious than maybe we are with this cup. It's difficult in some respects because I hear now a lot of justification for Championship sides to rest first teamers for the League Cup. It, as a side point, it has now become a nothing cup for me, and I think that's a separate debate that we might have at another podcast.
We can have that debate when we're winning it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I'll eat my words then, won't I, when that happens. But I think for Tuesday night, for this season, the priority remains the Premier League. If Dyche feels comfortable enough in around January time that the season's going well and we're probably doing enough to survive, I think he will concentrate any possible cup glory with the FA Cup. I just think the League Cup's too early in the season. It's not worth risking key players, and I'd expect Leeds to beat us.
Niggly. I think we'll play a sort of similar side to what we did against Blackburn. A few changes, but nothing drastic. I don't think we have a big enough squad to, you know, to make a full 11 switch. While I think Dyche won't be upset if we go out, I think it's, I don't think of the best word for it. I don't think he's such a, I don't think he's the type of person who isn't competitive in every game he plays. I think he expects us to go out and win every game we play. There will be changes, but I think it won't be a side that's not capable of beating a team like Leeds, and I expect us to win.
Very quickly, yes, no answer. Does Nick Pope play?
Yes.
Yes.
There we go. So on to the weekend. Huddersfield has started the season very well. Sit just above us on goal difference. We've already come unstuck against unfancied opposition at Turf this season against West Brom. Could Huddersfield be the same story, Nattersfield?
I thought you were saying Nattersphere. Then I was like, it's like the atmosphere, but my atmosphere. I'm gonna corner that phrase.
That's it, yeah.
Natalie. I feel like Saturday's game is going to be a little bit more of a challenge than I was hoping it was going to be. Essentially, well, I had a really interesting debate with somebody about this the other day, and I think this is a really important point to think about, in that there's part of me that just can't spend the entire season worrying about relegation and counting points and worrying about bonus points that other sides pick up and worrying about who's going to go up and who's going to stay up. I just feel like I just need to get to March and see where we are and worry about it then if we're getting close. But that's really hard to do, because everything about me is looking at the six or seven sides who I think are going to be in the mix at the end of the season. And Huddersfield, Brighton and Newcastle are, of course, in those bottom three that we would really hope to go down. If Huddersfield don't go down this season or Brighton don't go down, there is a big club going down in their place. So in that sense, it's frustrating that Huddersfield have had the start that they've had, because you want them to have struggled to adapt to the Premier League. You don't want them to have had as many points on the board. Now, saying that, they were blessed with a good start. If you look at the fixture list, they had winnable games, but they also had a lot of six-pointers in there. And Huddersfield did exactly what they were supposed to do. They won the most of those games and they drew where they needed to. It now starts getting tougher for them because they've got some tougher fixtures. And I'm going to put us in that bracket. Burnley away at Turf Moor is a tough fixture. It's going to be one of the tougher ones that they've come across so far. So, yeah, it's frustrating for us that it's not going to be as comfortable as I was hoping it was going to be. I don't think Dyche or the players expected it to be. I think that's just from a fan perspective. Saying that, we are now in our second season and I think that we should, at home, have more than enough to stop Huddersfield from scoring and to put a couple in the back of the net ourselves. So as worried as I am from a results perspective, I'm feeling pretty confident that we've got enough to beat them.
Let's hope so. And just to come full circle, we started the podcast with James talking about Scott Arfield and we're going to end it in the same way. James, does Arfield keep his place in the team if Hendrick's fit? And is there another risk of another 4-4-2? What do you think Sean Dyche does with this with the lineup at the weekend?
I think it's a difficult one. Obviously, not sure how serious Hendrick's injury was, sort of what his recovery has been like, whether Darcy's maybe going to be wanting to be a little bit cautious. I mean, it's potential that if he's sort of 100% fit, we might see him a little bit against Leeds, just to sort of give him a little run out last 20 minutes sort of thing, just to see how he's feeling. And that might make a part in the decision on Saturday. But obviously, Arfield's had those two really good games, but they've both been away from home. And obviously, in the last home game, we went back to 4-4-2. So, I mean, it's difficult to say because I could easily see Dyche going back to 4-4-2 against all performance evidence, even though obviously we came away with a great win last time at home. It wasn't necessarily the best performance of the season. I'd like to see him stick with Arfield. I think you've got to reward players for performances, and Arfield's undoubtedly had two great performances playing in that role, and I think he deserves another crack at it.
Natalie's just put in our chat, no, no, and no. So I'm guessing you're in favour of Hendrick, Natalie.
I am, yes. But listen, there's a reason for this, and it's no disrespect to Scott Arfield. I think he's done a fantastic job, but Hendrick is a better player. I think Arfield has got a really important role to play this season in covering for the midfield if somebody does get injured or suspended. And he's done a fantastic job in that five-man midfield, and he's carving out that specialty role for himself, as James talked about earlier. To put Arfield in before Hendrick, I think, is a mistake. I think we should be looking to improve the squad, and Hendrick is a better midfielder, he's got more quality about him. So I think at least start Hendrick if he's available. If he's not 100% there for a full game, then you've got the option of bringing Arfield on, and he'll deputise very, very well, but not in place of Hendrick.
Okay, and that's all, folks. Thanks to Natalie and James for your contributions throughout the podcast. Thanks to the other Nick Pope. And thanks especially to you for listening. If you've enjoyed this week's podcast, please share it on social media and give us a rating on iTunes. It really helps us. And make sure you send us your thoughts and reactions and what you think of what we've talked about, and also what you think of the Leeds game and the Huddersfield game. You can email them to podcast@noneinever.net, or you can tweet them to @noneinever. So stay tuned for a podcast clip from this time a year ago. Natalie's in the hot seat next week when hopefully we'll be celebrating 2 Turf Moor wins. Until then, thanks for listening. Bye.
Burnley beating 3-0 at Leicester City. Second straight 3-0 defeat on the road. Not a great performance at all, it's got to be said, from Burnley. But
and it could have been worse, but it wasn't. But in all the games so far, we've not been that far off the pace, and then on Saturday we were, it wasn't really like we were in the same league as Leicester.